So how do they have any effort to maintain any sort of social distancing in the NBA? Because like in baseball, like some of the players are actually like wearing masks even on the field, certainly in the dugout. In baseball, you're pretty spread out across the field by and large. You know, is there anything like that in the NBA, or is it just free for all?
Okay, so I think their solution has been fascinating. So they took like 22 teams, like the 22 best teams,
Who are how many teams are in the
hunt? 30. The 22 teams that are in the hunt for the playoffs.
How would you like to be one of the 8 out of 30 teams? Like, you just didn't make the cut. we're gonna cut it at 22.
All right, so welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. We're exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff. With me, as always, Pastor David Bowen.
How are we doing, Patrick?
And our guest co-host Elise is still on vacation.
Man, tell you what, we have got to renegotiate our contracts. This is ridiculous.
The funny thing is, I'm also on vacation this week. And here I am.
Vacation-ish.
I'm back home. All right, so I've got some news for us. Well, but before we get there, just a little let everybody know. This week, we are continuing our monthly series on a deep dive into a book of the Bible. So we've been going chronologically through the Bible. So 2 months ago, we did Genesis, last month, Exodus, and we're going to continue that path for now. And we're going to do Leviticus.
We should also say we're just going in order that the books are in the Bible. Coincidentally, that's chronologically, but that's not like, we set out like first book, second book, third, not like time.
Yeah. Usually, most books of the Bible, especially, are now in chronological order.
For now.
It does, it plays fast and loose with that a little bit.
Chronology gets messy. But yeah, we're going into Leviticus today.
Yeah, and if you've never read Leviticus, I think it's an interesting read.
Yeah.
But we'll get there.
We will.
Because first I got some news. All right, do you like wearing a mask?
Define like. I mean, I do it because I feel like it's my social responsibility for the betterment of humanity. But I don't think to myself, man, I'm going to do this no matter what, forever and ever. Amen. This is like my new style. And I'm no.
I hear you. Yeah, I'm the same way. Never really into the mask, pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And here I am. Again, I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's a smart thing to do. I think it is the kind thing to do. But nobody likes doing it.
Right.
It's this thing. So I've got some two new stories here about some interesting ways to convince people to obey by our mask and coronavirus rule.
All right.
Social distancing rules. So first, I'll take us to Berlin.
Okay. All right. Germany. All right.
Yes, in Germany. Now, I'm sure you've seen
this. Can
you
do this in your best German accent for us?
I don't do accents.
That's probably smart. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be offensive to any German listeners out there.
Yeah. There's really no way to do it without offending it, so yeah, it's probably smart. Okay.
Yes. Ich bin ein Berliner.
Yeah, there you go.
That's, All right, so...
Tear down this mask. No, wait, that's not right. That's.
I'm sure you've seen out and about people wearing the mask, and I'm using that in quotes here, because it's not covering their nose.
Right.
You've seen this, right?
Yep.
Evidently,
the nose,
people
nose
never,
exposure.
I've never sneezed before.
Right.
Or, breathed before. Like, that's a part of the respiratory system. You got to cover that nose.
You do.
So one of their public transportation things came up with a new campaign because too many people were wearing their masks, but underneath the nose. And this is how they're going to do that. They're encouraging riders to not wear deodorant.
So... In order to encourage people to keep the mask over their nose, they're encouraging riders not to wear deodorant, assuming the smell of the lack of deodorant is going to cause people to put the thing over their...
They're like, oh, you want your nose out, guess what you got to deal with? Everybody's BO on this.
I've never found covering my nose to be that effective at preventing me from smelling smells. Is that like a real thing?
I don't think so. I think this is actually a little tongue-in-cheek, but I do think it's funny.
Yeah, it's funny,
I would probably agree. I don't think my mask would protect me from smells unless you have Corona.
Right. Does Corona have a smell? Does it?
Well, isn't it like a lack of smell and taste one of the symptoms?
Oh, yeah, that is a thing, yep.
So, yeah, then there you go. So if you don't smell the BO, then you're like, ooh, maybe get this checked out. Yeah.
You probably shouldn't be on that bus.
Yeah. Probably not. If you think you have corona, you should know. Definitely not be on the list, and definitely put the mask over the face. Right. So that's one way. I'll take you down to Florida now. Our good friends in Florida.
What did Florida man do this time?
Florida man's always active. So a Miami hotel, a customer there, was concerned about social distancing in the lobby and shouted, "None of y'all are social distancing," and fired 4 warning shots into the air to convince people to social distance.
Yeah, I would social distance from that. Yeah, for sure.
Although, if you're running from gunfire, I'm not sure you're as concerned about the 6-foot rule with the people around you, your fellow fleers.
That's a fair point, but I would definitely distance away from that. That's...
I think of it more of like, hey, you're in Florida, you got to speak Florida's language. Yeah. You know, like,
yep.
This is...
Win in Rome.
Win in Florida, fire guns.
Fire shots into the air. I would have expected that, frankly, to be like a Texas thing. But, Florida making a run for it. So, hey, good for you guys. That's great.
Yeah. So, if and when church starts to open up, do you think that should be something out there?
No.
We could be firing some gunshots?
No.
To convince people for those
no.
things. Okay, no gunshots.
I'm going to go ahead and say we probably shouldn't even make jokes about firing gunshots in churches. How about that?
Yeah, that's probably true. Yes.
I did hear a thing, though, that we make fun of these Florida man stories because it seems like there's always just crazy news coming out of Florida. And it's not that statistically crazy stuff happens in Florida more often. It's just that Florida's freedom of information laws are so lax that the press can get to it that much faster and that much easier. Yeah. So we hear about Florida a whole lot more. So, we poke fun at Florida because, they kind of hang out there in the Caribbean. But, no, it's all of us. We're all Florida man.
Yeah. So there you go. Some new ways to combat coronavirus.
All right.
Don't wear deodorant.
Don't wear deodorant. Fire gunshots in the air.
Yes. Warning shots. Just warning shots.
Yeah. Well, I assume warning shots are in the air, right?
Yeah. And you can get blanks, too. That make
me... Oh, that's true. Just fire like a starter's pistol.
Yeah.
Let's go around saying, runners, take your marks, and then fire your gun into the air everywhere you go. That also would probably get people to walk away from you, frankly. So,
all right, let's jump into Leviticus.
Yeah, let's do this. So Leviticus, third book of the Bible, right?
That's
Genesis,
correct, yes.
Exodus, Leviticus. Third book of the Torah. The first 5 are called the Torah, the books of the law. I learned this for the first time. The early rabbinic name for the book of Leviticus was actually the Torat Kohanim. Torat Kohanim. Sorry to all of our Hebrew speakers out there for butchering that. Mm-hmm. But it literally translates to the priest's manual, which I think is actually a really helpful way to think about Leviticus, because there's a lot of stuff in here that are instructions for the priests of Israel for how they're going to do their work, how they're going to do their work on behalf of Israel. The book of Leviticus doesn't really advance the narrative, right? We've had this great flowing story, and Leviticus kind of steps out of all of that and says, okay, let's pause everything else that happens, let's pause that, and let's do this big excursus on how you're supposed to be living together and what you're supposed to be doing and what's right, wrong, clean, unclean, et cetera, et cetera. And then we'll go back to Numbers, and the narrative will keep moving on. So if you're looking to find out what happened to Moses after the end of Exodus, don't read Leviticus. You're not going to find out. But there's lots of great stuff here, and you should read Leviticus for other things. So I think first it's probably helpful for us to kind of review where we've been. So briefly, mm-hmm. Patrick, we can remember Genesis. If we want to sum that up in like 2 sentences, humanity chooses not to trust God, but God still selects one family to be God's blessing for the world, right? So that's Abraham and Abraham's lineage. They're going to be the ones through whom God is going to bless the world. That's Genesis in 2 sentences. And then we had Exodus, and the whole second half of Exodus, after God rescues God's people from Egypt, brings them out, they're in the wilderness, the whole second half is instructions for building this tabernacle. Another way I think of tabernacle is a sacred tent. This is going to be the holy tent where God's presence is going to dwell among the Israelites as they travel through the wilderness. The tent is going to be the place where that happens. It's also going to be the place where God's going to institute sacrifice processes and everything like that. It's going to be at the center of their camp everywhere they go. And at the end of Exodus, in chapter 40, we didn't actually cover this on our Exodus podcast, so I'll just summarize this for us quickly. At the end of Exodus, God's presence dwells fully in the tent. This is the very end of Exodus, last four verses. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Whenever the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on each stage of their journey. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, before the eyes of all the house of Israel at each stage of their journey. So that's how Exodus ends, and that's where we hit the pause button. And now we're going to talk all about this holiness, this purity of God, and how Israel is going to interact with that. But I find it fascinating that we end this story, or that we pause this story, with God's presence coming to dwell in the tent, and hearing that Moses himself, who has been up on the mountain with God multiple times in Exodus, been up on the mountain, received the law, Moses himself cannot go into the tent because the holiness is too overwhelming, too powerful, I guess is a way to think of it. I'll pause there for a moment.
Yeah, I think it's also, not only is God's holiness so great, it's also the rebellion of Israel is also so great. That spoiler alert, at the beginning of Numbers, Moses can go into the tent.
But he can't yet, Patrick. Come on.
So I'm saying, so it's not just the holiness.
Right.
It's also about the rebellion of Israel.
Yes.
Those things are interplayed together. So Leviticus, you know, in its greatest forms, I'd say, is like, this is what how Israel is going to separate itself from the surrounding countries to live differently. That it's going to look a lot different than the culture of Egypt, the culture of the Canaanites, the Philistines, the whatever Steens, you know, whatever, any other things they interact with. Israel's going to look different. And that is going to keep them connected to that tabernacle. It's an awesome image that God is putting forth to his people, right? Like, you're going to have this giant tent. God lives in the tent, and everybody lives around the tent, and then we just keep going on our journey, setting up this tent everywhere we go. That's a powerful and awesome image that lasts throughout the book, the first five books of the Bible, and then once we start entering the promised land and start settling down, that kind of the tabernacle imagery shifts. And eventually lands on a temple, a permanent place.
Yeah, but things get complicated when we get to the temple.
Things will get complicated here. but we're going into Leviticus. Like you mentioned, the narrative is stopping. We're taking time to really delve into a lot of different stuff. So we're going to talk about some sacrifices. We're going to talk about some festivals. We're going to talk a lot about rules, most of which will sound weird to us in 2020. That they'll say, like, those things sound odd or unnecessary, right? Like, we would probably maybe land on some of those things.
But we'll
break those things down as we go on. Did I miss anything there?
No, I think that's great. Yeah. So we get into this, we get into the book of Leviticus, and you know, if you want to look at the large framework of Leviticus, you can think of it in kind of seven sections. And you might be helpful to think of it as seven sections that kind of rise to a peak and then come back down. And so on each end of these sections, you kind of have parallel stories happening with a central story in the middle, if you want to think of that. So I'll try to make sense of this as visually as I can through a podcast as we're going through this. So in sections 1 and 7, we're talking all about rituals. Ritual is one way for Israel to understand how they can live in proximity to God's holiness, right? In spite of their corruption, in spite of their lack of holiness, these rituals are one way that they can live in proximity to God's holiness. And so the first part of the book, 1 through 7, talks all about sacrifices, and it has sacrifices for all sorts of different stuff. You can do a sacrifice for giving thanks for things. You can do a sacrifice because you did something wrong. You can do a sacrifice when the harvest is coming or when you're planting things. There, all sorts of different sacrifices are listed out there. At the end then, in chapters 23 through 27, end of the book, we get these rituals of festivals. And these are actually, these are great because these are festivals that are carried on even today in the Hebrew tradition that, you know, go back thousands of years at this point. You know, we think Easter is cool because it's like 2,000 years old, and the Jewish people are like, yeah, well, check out Passover, man. And I'm like, all right, touche. So you got all these lists of festivals and ways that you're going to remember the stories of what God has done. This is how you're going to commemorate what God does and God's faithfulness to you. That comes out in the festivals. So that's the lowest part of the mountain on either end, right? And then if we climb up the mountain from either side, we've got sections 2 and 6 where we're talking all about the priests. And we talked about the priests a little bit before. In the first section, chapters 8 through 10, you've got how we're going to ordain priests. What's the process for mm-hmm. that? Spoiler alert, there's a sacrifice involved in that too.
A lot of sacrifices.
And then at the end, chapters 21 through 22, you've got the higher standards for priests. Like, listen, priests aren't just going to be regular people. They're going to have a higher expectation put on them than the average Israelite. Now, Patrick, I have a question for you.
Yes.
In a modern context, right? Mm-hmm. Just walking around the woodlands, Houston, wherever, 2020, with your mask on, how would you define a priest?
So, you know, like we would probably say a priest, you know, one called and ordained by God mm-hmm. or a church mm-hmm. to administer sacraments, to administer a word, to be, to work within a local congregation or system of congregations.
Yes. Yeah. We probably typically think Catholic, maybe yeah. Episcopal, if we're like really aware of like language, but like, I'm not called a priest. No one around Lord of Life calls me a priest. In the vernacular of the society, some people might see me as a priest.
Yeah, I would say, you know, in a blurring of, as people get further away from, like, religious mm-hmm. imagery or as part of our cultural understanding, you wear a collar
right.
sometimes, a black shirt and a collar.
Currently, I'm wearing one, yes.
Priest, that's a priest, man. Yep. That's how they would view that.
Yep.
And even potentially even a Baptist preacher mm-hmm. in a suit mm-hmm. might be considered a priest, you know,
yep.
by our culture. So, you know, but I think in the greatest sense, even if we don't use the term priest to place on you or other pastors, it is supposed to kind of mean the similar thing. It's just different vernacular.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think the other thing that, and maybe I'm putting too much onto people, but I think the other thing that people often unconsciously attribute to priests, pastors, etc., is this kind of special relationship with mm-hmm. God.
Sure.
As if, oh, the priest has a relationship with God that's closer than I could ever get, so I need to get close to the priest so that I can, through the priest, be close to God.
Yes, I would say that's probably true
yeah.
for many people.
Yeah, in some ways, it even comes out in like, oh, well, the priest has, I don't want to say special powers, because I don't think we really think priests have special powers, but, you know, in the act of communion, right? You know, we at in a Lutheran church, in the Catholic church, we say, hey, the pastor, the priest, they're the ones who preside at communion. And because we set that apart for pastors to do, sometimes it kind of gets us like, oh, well, the pastors have, you know, magic fingers, mm-hmm. or the pastors have this magic ability. I have no magic ability other than I've been trained theologically to handle or to do this thing in a certain way. There's nothing mm-hmm. that I do that makes communion special. And frankly, even within Lutheranism, you know, we have an understanding of extraordinary circumstances that anybody can step up to that plate in order to administer the sacraments in times of extraordinary circumstances. But that's all aside from the point. When we're talking about the priests in Leviticus, it's easy for us to start to think, oh, well, the priests are supposed to be this special power group that has, you know, these powers and this special relationship with God. I really don't think that's the intention of Leviticus. I think that for Leviticus, the priests were set apart, and I want to use that language potentially. They were set apart, but they were not different from the people of Israel. The only mm-hmm. difference was the expectation that they, the priests, would be teaching both by word and by action what the difference between clean and unclean, or pure and impure, holy and unholy, what those differences are. Because if we remember back to Exodus, and we hit this pretty hard in our Exodus episode, God wanted to have this direct relationship with all of Israel, right? God calls all of Israel up to hear the word, to hear the law, to hear God's voice directly. Mm-hmm. And Israel says, no way, Moses, you go talk to God, because we're terrified of that.
Yeah.
And so to me, I think that priests are really kind of a concession from God to say, okay, you know, you're terrified of this, and maybe rightly so, maybe you can't handle this. So I'm going to set up this priesthood who are going to be the ones who especially follow my law and help you to understand my law. But mm-hmm. the responsibility to have that proximity of relationship with God is still on the entire nation of Israel, right?
Yeah.
It's not on Israel to go through the priest to be close to God. it's on Israel to be close to God by hearing from the priest how to live rightly in the world.
Okay.
And so I think that's a helpful thing for us to think about, that the priests were not there to be separate, to have magic powers. The priests were there to help Israel learn how to live rightly. And I don't know. I think that there's an element of that when we're talking about priests today, too. But that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
All right. So then we get to, we're going a little further up the mountain. So we've got our base and our, I don't know geology. So we've got the bottom of the mountain and a little bit higher. And now we're a little bit higher. We've got sections 3.
The summit is the top, I can tell you.
All right. We're not to the summit yet. We're not there. So we've got sections 3 and 5. And these are all the purity laws. And this is probably, for me, you know, sacrifices are kind of weird, but we're kind of familiar with this idea. The priesthood, also kind of weird, but it's just like, okay, priests are set aside to do certain things. Purity laws is, for me, where I think Leviticus gets the weirdest, if I can say it that way. Like, it's just, it's the most out of context from our current culture. And so this would be where we're talking about the difference between things that are clean or unclean or pure and impure. We're going to get dietary laws. And in fact, this whole section from chapters 11 through 15 is food laws, skin disease, what to do when people are sick in the camp and things like that. There's all these ritually unclean things to do. And then the next section, section 5, is going to be all about moral purity. How does the society at large act in a way that it is moral and right? And there it is a distinction here that I think is helpful. With the cleanliness of the individual, it was not inherently sinful to become ritually unclean, right? Mm-hmm. You get a skin disease, you get chicken pox in the camp, and you'd be ritually unclean as long as you had the chicken pox, right? They didn't call it chicken pox, but yeah, you'd get that. It's not wrong or sinful to have chicken pox. You just can't be close to the holiness of God while you're impure in that way. In the same way, if you touch the blood of a certain animal, or if you touch a corpse of something, you become ritually unclean. It's not inherently sinful to have done that, but you can't be close to the proximity of God in that state. And so you have to just wait. And there's always a path to forgiveness. There's always a path to redemption. There's always a way to take what is unclean and have that be made clean. And I think that's a really important distinction that I want to circle back to in a little bit. But God always sets up a way. Whatever is unclean, God always sets up a way to make that clean again.
Okay.
I'll pause there for a minute if you have reflections on that before we get to the summit, the apex, if you will.
The peak, yes. Also the peak. That's...
Yeah, the
so,
peak.
So I think you're right. Like, this is part of Leviticus that may be really hard to read, maybe difficult to read. Mm-hmm. One, it's not written in a way that's like fun,
right?
Like, it's not a story. It's really just a list of laws, and it gets a list of laws for ancient culture. So it's weird. Like, some things are in there you'd say like, I am on board with. I think these are right. Some things in there, I'm sure many of our readers are going to say, I don't think that this holds up. It certainly does not going to apply to us today. And so I think that can be a tough section for sure some people to read. Now, as we kind of take a look at the grand scheme of Leviticus as we kind of move forward, I think that, you know, we'll kind of touch base on a little bit more of this. So let's finish up the summary, and right, we'll get into a little bit more.
Sure. All right. So we're at the peak now. So we've got our foundation built up on either side with this kind of move towards the peak. The central peak of Leviticus is the Day of Atonement. Which is probably, I'm not Jewish myself, but I would say probably one of the most important Jewish festivals, holidays, religious rites in existence. And the center of this process is two goats being brought into the temple.
Mm-hmm.
One goat is killed. The blood is drained right on the altar, straight to God. And that goat dies as a substitute. For the punishment of all the sins, because essentially you're living in this huge camp, and even if you're doing all these rituals to try to maintain your purity, there are probably sins and things that are going unnoticed or undealt with, and so there's uncleanness in the camp. And so once a year, you have this Day of Atonement. First goat dies as a substitute for that. Second goat, the priest prays and puts the hands on the goat, and the sins of the camp are symbolically placed on that goat, and that goat is sent out into the wilderness. And so you have the one goat dying as the substitute. You have the second goat removing the sins, symbolizing God removing the sins from the people. And that happens every single year on this Day of Atonement. And it's that central act of redemption, that act of restoring the holiness of the people. That's the center apex of the Levitical mm-hmm. story. I don't know that Levitical is a word, but we're going to use it. It's the central apex of the story of Leviticus. And I think that's really beautiful because in the ancient world, right, if you had relationships with gods, you never really knew how to please the gods. You did sacrifices all the time to try to to try to gain the gods' favor, but you really didn't know. Like, is this working? Is this going to do what we want it to do? Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't.
Like, oh, rain is falling, and we want rain, so God must be pleased.
Yeah, God's happy with us.
Oh, rain's not following, God must be angry.
Yeah, yeah. Rain's not falling, so more sacrifices. And sacrifice, and oh, well, we finally sacrificed enough, the rain started falling again. So,
or now there's too much rain, God is now angry.
Right,
again,
yeah, yeah, whoops. Sure. too many sacrifices, bring something, no, never mind. You never really knew, but God, again, right, God is setting Israel apart. God is also distinguishing God's self as different from the gods that Israel and the cultures around them would have experienced. And so Leviticus, again, is given as a message of love to the Israelites to say, look, this is exactly how you are called to live when you're living in proximity to my holiness. This is what God is saying to the Israelites. This is the gift that I'm giving to you. Live this way so that you can thrive in proximity to my holiness, and in doing so become a blessing to all the nations around you. That you mm-hmm. you shine like the sun in a way that other nations don't understand because of your proximity to my holiness and the way that you're going to live because of it. And I think that having the Day of Atonement as the kind of central apex of this Levitical story really does highlight that at the center of the story is God's desire to redeem humanity, to restore right relationship, to remove sins from the people, and to call us back to living in God's presence.
Yeah, I think obviously the New Testament is going to pick up on this imagery and place it onto Jesus.
Yep.
That this will be
spoiler alert.
The once and for all atonement, the once and for all sacrifice is Jesus.
Yeah.
This is why Christians don't sacrifice animals. This is why
reasons we don't sacrifice animals. Yeah.
One of many, but this is a theological reason why we don't. That the atonement happened once and for all in Jesus, removing the sins and the barriers between man and God. Yeah. So this happened.
Yep.
So this is awesome. It's also, you know, if you're like word origins or phrase origins, where we get the term scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goat that gets sent out into the wilderness.
Yep.
So when we say that, oh, they're a scapegoat, meaning they're taking the fall for the larger group.
Yep.
That's that goat. You know, like that has that biblical imagery right there into it. So I think that's really interesting as well.
Yeah.
So again, Leviticus is not beach reading. Like, this is not fun to kind of crack open. But I do think there's some interesting things that maybe now we can kind of talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
Some greater themes as you've taken us up and down the mountain. For me, one of the first themes is that God's people immediately are called for two things. And this is something I think sometimes the church struggles in both of these. One is sacrifice and the other is celebration.
Mm-hmm.
That both those things are part of this original story. We have festival and sacrifice. Those mm-hmm. are our two bookends. So the church, I'm not sure, does always a great job of doing, feast and famine and recognizing those things. Sometimes they're kind of like every week is kind of in the middle for most worship services, for most congregational communities. It's kind of like we're both a little bit feasting and a little bit famining all at the same time. Like, we don't really have a period where like God is good and we will only celebrate right now. And we definitely don't have a period where like we all need to sit in ashcloth and repent right now. Not just like I sinned, I need to repent, but we sinned. Yeah.
So,
and we need to sit there.
I hear that. I want to challenge it only to say that I think the intent of the liturgy is to do that, right? I think, you know, if we follow the liturgy, particularly within the Lutheran Church, historically we would always start with a confession. That's where every worship service should start, and then you always end with the celebration of communion of God's grace revealed in this bread and the wine of Jesus. So I think the liturgy is set up to do that. I think we don't embrace it. I think that we don't live into the fullness of what that potential is for us.
Mm-hmm. I think it's not necessarily like that we're not trying that. I think we're missing the lamentation aspect of it, of like,
yeah,
we as a community are just spent time in mourning.
Yep.
And that's it. That's, you just come here and we just mourn. Or we as a community are spending time in festival, and that's it. You just come in here and we celebrate, and it's still worship, it's still both those things. I think sometimes we don't do a great job of really celebrating those things as distinct things.
Yeah.
The liturgy combines the two together into one service, and I don't think we do as good a job of saying this is just mourning, mm-hmm, or this is, mm-hmm, just celebration.
Yeah,
and we have
fair.
Both those things, yeah, present in Leviticus.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the themes that I picked up on, like when I was kind of reading or reflipping through Leviticus, because I did not read all of Leviticus to prepare for this. I'll say that.
Come on,
I have read it in the past, but for this, I kind of did a little flip through. Let's do a little, you know, let's get kind of get. I'm on vacation, so you know, we're just
sure.
Again,
not beach,
not my
reading.
Beach reading. Yes,
you weren't on vacation at the beach, so you know, is it
fair enough? Fair enough. Yeah, that's true.
Leviticus is at least car reading. Come on, that's fine.
That would have been great.
Maybe not while you're driving. You just get the audiobook playing for the
whole
car.
We're going to listen to this Leviticus audiobook for our drive here. I hope that's cool with you.
I think that's when your wife kindly looks at you and says, I'm taking a nap now. Good luck.
Or, no, we're not going to do that. Like, yeah. So I think that's one of the neat themes. Another theme is we're going to get into these rules, right? Like,
yeah.
So the big question that people are going to have reading these rules, and I have, is, do they apply anymore?
Yeah.
Should we follow the rules of Leviticus? All right, what do you think here?
Well, I think there's two things that we can think about. I mean, the first is, when we look at the rules, by and large, they're not bad rules, especially when we put them into a cultural context. You know, I think you've done, I don't remember if we talked about this on the podcast or this was just something we talked about off podcast, but you did the class on Paul a while back and you talked about,
sure,
well, was Paul progressive for his time, or was he, you know, in slavery, for instance, right? Paul never outright condemns slavery, but was Paul's stance on slavery still progressive for the time, or was he genuinely in favor of this practice? And I think that's something that we need to ask with some of these laws too. Like, are the laws, within their cultural context, I think a lot of the laws are actually progressive comparatively to the cultures that they're surrounding by. And so they're moving Israel in a direction away, again, setting them apart, moving them in a direction towards the holiness of God, and separating them from the communities that are around them. And so I think even the laws that, by our standards, because we have continued to move, hopefully, we've continued to move towards the holiness of God, and so there might be laws that, by our standards, we'd say, well, that's ludicrous, or that's out of date, or that's not in touch with societal norms. I think there's still an element of, at the time, this was completely radical and was setting up an entirely new kind of relationship for the people. But, mm-hmm, we also, as Christians, know that Jesus dies to set us free from not just from the law, but from this idea that we have to follow every single thing perfectly, right? And you know, so for us, we can never follow the law, even if we try. That's the whole understanding of our sinful nature, that we can never follow the law. We need Jesus. And so we always rely on Jesus in order for us to be in that right relationship with God. Jesus is the reason that we're able to do that, not our ability to follow the law. And so then we're able to use the law to both convict us of our sin and to draw us into, or to draw us into an awareness of Jesus dying for us. That's kind of the function that the law serves there. So I think I've been talking around your question more than actually answering it. Do we need to follow the law? It's not what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, are there laws in here that I think are meaningful for us to follow? Yes. But that's not what's going to save me. Following the laws of Leviticus is not what's going to put me in right relationship with God.
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about these laws of Leviticus. And some we would say, yeah, these make sense. Most cultures in our world have some version of these things. This is going to be laws against incest. This is going to be laws against stealing, lying, defrauding your neighbor. These are things that I'm like, yeah, these are things that makes sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the concepts that, you know, I like looking at the scripture as a whole is the idea of like, well, this is part of an older covenant with God and Israel. Jesus resets that covenant. Covenant kind of means like contract between God and humanity. And so these things don't necessarily apply to us anymore. So I don't think that we should follow the laws of Leviticus solely because they are in the book of Leviticus.
Right.
Like, I don't think that. So I do think it kind of gives, like, these are the rules for an ancient culture that made sense at the time. That does not mean that they're translatable today. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't follow any of these rules, because I think we should not steal, not defraud our neighbor, not lie, mm-hmm. Things like that, but not because it's in Leviticus,
right.
But because those things are wrong, and they're wrong in the New Testament, and this under this new covenant.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it does lead all of us to sometimes playing fast and loose with a little bit of Leviticus, because some, you know, conservative churches out there will say, like, well, look, here in Leviticus, we've got laws against homosexuality, sure. Potentially against transgender people, because there's cross-dressing laws mm-hmm. in Leviticus. Mm-hmm. There's laws against tattoos, you know, like things like that. So it's easy for a conservative church or to read this in a conservative light, be like, there, it's God's plain right there. And it's probably easier for maybe myself, maybe for you, and maybe more left-leaning Christians to say, well, look, in Leviticus, it has all these great laws about how you should treat immigrants and
yeah.
foreigners,
yeah.
things that we should celebrate and do. And so both sides can get a little picky choosy, right? Mm-hmm. With like, this one applies to us today for sure.
Yeah.
And this one does not, right. for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. So I think it's, for me, it's safest to say none of them, in and of themselves, because they're in the book of Leviticus, apply today. But that doesn't mean there's not great insight into them. And so one of the things I think is insightful is God has strong concerns for his people about issues surrounding ethics, issues surrounding sex, issues surrounding justice, and issues surrounding immigrants and foreigners. God has a lot of desire for that, for his people. And so even if those same laws don't apply to us directly today, I think those issues do to today's church. So like, we as Christians in 2020 in America should be concerned about strong sexual ethics. We should be concerned about commitment to justice. We should be concerned about how we engage with our neighbor ethically. And we should be concerned about the foreigner and immigrant
mm-hmm,
amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
What that looks like, we might not exactly get from Leviticus, but the themes, I think, do translate to today.
Yeah.
So that's my inclination from
that. No, I think that's a helpful place for us to take.
Yeah,
because, you know, we do. I mean, we have this passage in the New Testament where we hear all Scripture is God breathed and is useful
sure.
for teaching, training, rebuking, and something in righteousness. And you know, when Paul is writing that, you know, whether or not he's speaking about all of the letters of the New Testament, I don't know if he was writing about that, but he's certainly speaking about the Torah. He's certainly speaking about the prophets.
Sure.
And Leviticus definitely was in Paul's wheelhouse because he refers to Leviticus and he was trained as a rabbi and, you know, in that school. And so, yeah, he knew this document well. And, you know, it has its use. Even though Paul will say, hey, you're not bound by the food laws. You're not bound by purity laws. You know, you can eat whatever you want to eat because you're saved by the grace of God. But Paul will also say, well, but if you're causing another Christian to stumble, cut it out, because that's not what mm-hmm. you should be doing. Like, if you are doing anything that is preventing someone else from knowing Jesus, cut it out. Stop that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also pretty safe to say most of us are breaking Levitical laws on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I'm
wearing a shirt that's breaking Levitical laws right now.
Yeah, so...
It's got multiple threads.
Yeah, 50-50 blend.
You're out.
You ate a cheeseburger, potentially you're breaking Levitical law.
Yep, you're out.
Yeah,
done.
You know, so
the cheeseburger's a weird one, because it's like based on a passage about boiling a goat in its mother's milk.
Yeah.
And that has been interpreted as don't put dairy with meat. I'm like, oh, man, that's so sad. So many good things yeah. come from putting dairy with meat.
Yeah. So I think that's safe to bet. Like, most of us, again, are breaking the rules of Leviticus all the time.
Yeah.
And so...
I cut my beard.
Yeah, there you go.
Done. I'm out.
Me too. Even though it is...
Yeah, you, You've got a nice longer. Full one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the hairs on the side of my head.
Yep.
You know, they grew out and I cut them back.
Yeah.
So these are all levitical things. You know, interesting rules for an ancient culture, but we break these rules.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to get into the place of like, well, I know I break the Levitical laws, but you should follow these ones.
That's
I
right.
chose. You know, so, you know, so I think that that's not helpful. But again, I think I land on it's important to treat immigrants and foreigners with compassion and humanity, but not because of Leviticus.
Right. Leviticus is not the reason, but it is also important to do this.
Yes, Leviticus just tells me God cares about those things.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. That these things matter. Yeah.
So I think it'd be fun right. if we choose a couple of our favorite Levitical laws to highlight.
Okay.
Briefly.
Sure.
Does that sound like a good plan?
Yeah.
So I've
let
got
me, let me
I've got one.
Let me find let me I gotta find some here.
Yeah, I've got one to start us off. This is from Leviticus chapter 12. According to Leviticus chapter 12, and I'm going to skip over some verses just for our listeners here, but essentially chapter 12 verses 1 through 6 establish that when women give birth, if they give birth to a male, they are ritually unclean for a week, 1 week. And if you give birth to a female, you're ritually unclean for 2 weeks. Not really sure why, but 1 week if you give birth to a boy and 2 weeks if you give birth to a girl.
All right, another interesting one. Is I think this is Leviticus 19.
Ooh, I've got some from Leviticus 19 too. There's good stuff in there. What do you got?
Eating fruit from a tree within 4 years of planting it. So yeah. You plant your tree, you got to give it at least 4 years, and then you can start eating those apples.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not a botanist or a horticulturist, so I don't know if that's useful. But I think that's interesting. You know,
you do have to like grow a tree for several years before it fruits. I know that. I don't know if it's 4 years, but I know like trees don't bloom like the first year you plant them.
Well, then that should seem like if there's no fruit, you can't eat the fruit. Like, you know, that seems like a given.
That's a fair point. So is it 4 years from when the first fruit comes, or is it 4 years from when you plant the tree?
I believe it's from planting. Okay, again, I've not read this in Hebrew. I also sure. don't know Hebrew. Right. But it's
which makes it hard to do.
Yeah. So also in 19 here, you better stand in the presence of the elderly.
Yeah.
I think
so I should be standing every time you walk into the room.
That is
right?
true. Yeah. I am older. So... You definitely need to do that. So
yeah, so I got a couple here. This is from 19 verses 13 and 14. You shall not keep for yourself the wages of a laborer until morning. So those of us who get paid every 2 weeks, our companies are all breaking Levitical laws because they should sure. be paying us at the end of every day. You shall not revile the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, which is like a really good thing. I just imagine like, symbolically, I understand the stumbling block, but like the literal notion of like, no, don't put things in front of a blind person to trip them. I'm like, we had to say that? We had to put that in the law to establish that was a bad idea?
Yeah, I think that one is interesting. Plus, if you are making a sacrifice, there we've got like, I think this is interesting. You're going to sacrifice a cow. You can't sacrifice the cow's baby on the same day. You got to give a day's sure. break between calf and cow. You
know, yeah. like, have some mercy here.
Yeah, so yeah. that's I a like lot that. To that's take good. In. So,
yeah. You are not allowed to put two seeds of the different kinds into your field. So when you're planting your field, one seed. And mm-hmm. then in a different field, you can do a different seed. One thing at a time.
Yeah, so
I don't. How big does the field have to be? Like, can I do rows? Does that, or is like, do I have to like define
yeah,
the field?
Yeah, does that? If you have a path in between, is that a new field? What makes
right,
a,
yeah.
you know what separates a field from other field? These are
yeah.
good questions.
See, and this is now where we get midrash, because this is the Hebrew and rabbinic tradition of trying to explain all this stuff.
Sure.
And so you've got like the Talmud and other things like that, where people come along like, oh well, this. Means this, and then they do huge explanations and excurses on these passages because on their own they don't always make a lot of sense, and you're like, well, what am I actually supposed to do with this?
Sure. Yeah So I think that this is Leviticus. You know, anything else you'd like to add to our discussion here?
I think Leviticus is a worthwhile read. It's part of scripture. We should respect it and understand it. We should, you know, hold it as part of the canon and the story, because I think it does reveal a lot about who God is and how God wants to be working towards the redemption of all humanity and all of creation. but it is probably one of the books that is stranger by our modern standards, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, I think if you go into this with the idea of, like, let me figure out what this is going to tell me about the insights and heart of God for an ancient culture and the people of Israel, I think there's a lot to be discussed and digested there. But if you're just like, hey, let's just crack open the Bible and see what it says, I think you're going to be confused. I think you're going
to... Maybe don't start there.
I think you're going to walk away frustrated and being like, oh, this is not for me.
It would kind of be like reading the last book of a trilogy first, right? I mean, if you just...
Even worse than that, it's like reading the notes about a book, you know, like the appendix of the book of like...
All right, so it's like reading all the end notes to some textbook.
I really want to watch that new Avengers movie. Let me watch the credits first. You know, that would be kind of like jumping into Leviticus. There's value there, but that's not probably the value you're looking for. Yeah.
Let me watch Batman and Superman first. Like, I'll watch Batman versus Superman, and then I'll waste all my time doing that, and then I'll go back and read the good stuff in Avengers. That's what I'll do. All right, that joke wasn't as good as I hoped it would be. That's fine. Right. Don't worry about it.
All right, so where can you find us?
Hey, if you liked what you heard, you, of course, can find us at our website, beyondsundaypodcast.com, just like Shelley Herman did, who gave us a shout-out for our episode on cancel culture, commented on that episode on our website saying that she loved that episode. So, Shelley, thank you for letting us know that you liked that. We had a fun one with that one, too. Yeah. And we'd love to hear what you all think about these episodes or any of the other episodes. We are rapidly approaching 100 episodes, Patrick. I know I've been, like, building this up for a couple weeks now, but it's coming. We got to do something fun, so we got to think about what that's going to be. But you, of course, can find this podcast on any platform where you find a delightful podcast for your listening pleasure. We are there and ready for you, and we would love to hear back from you, so let us know what you think.
Absolutely. Thanks, Shelley. I also really like the cancel culture episode. It's one of my favorites. So it's fun. So
really,
it is.
That became a favorite. All right.
Yeah, I put it up there in my mental, notes of like which ones did I really, really like. That's one of them.
Yeah, I don't think that one cracked my top five, but it was a good one. I enjoyed it.
There you go. All right. So, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with more Beyond Sunday.